You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to the newest lecture edition of the Russian Orthodox Nationalist here at Radio Albion. It is late in the evening of the 8th of February, 2025. And as I like to do, beginning of each show, to thank my donors, not just people who have sent me money, but those who have bought books, those who have sent me Bitcoin. I still don't have a P.O. box for normal mail, and but when I do, you guys will be the first to know. And don't forget my Patreon page, which I'm updating on a very regular basis. Russia is the center of world politics. It's the center of this show. It's the center of the Orthodox faith. It's the center of my life personally. That means that Russia's direction and ruling ideology decide or greatly influence the fate of the planet. That means her internal ideological struggles are of paramount importance, especially when they're based on mythic or just patently incorrect ideas. Now, we've dealt with this topic before, and we're going to deal with this topic again many more times. And it's trying to make sense out of the irritating tendency for Russians, including Russian young people, to look back or to construct the Stalin years as somehow a golden period, that he was a nationalist of some kind, even a religious figure. Now, I have spent many hours and many years, and so have so many others, refuting this myth that he was a nationalist, that he resurrected the church, etc. And many others have done it from many different backgrounds. It remains that Joseph Stalin remains a symbol of Russian strength and power, especially as concerns the Second World War, what they call the Great Patriotic War. That's the event that solidified communism on the world stage forever, and as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, solidified Stalin's rule without question. It remains the dominant event of the 20th century and everything that's come afterwards. Somehow, Stalin has remained this messianic figure, the Russian national leader in all capital letters. And in the struggles Russia has been forced to go through since the 90s, the claim is now more than ever, are his ideas necessary to punish evil and to restore the greatness of the empire? Now, to some extent, it's understandable. I can't overstress the suffering and the destruction of the 1990s. 80% of Russian capital either disappeared or was taken or was liquidated. The Great Criminal Revolution. And you had actual starvation. You had educated people. A draw. And of all places, the Chechen Republic, which, you know, Putin solved that problem. But this is the kind of thing that caused this nostalgia. Because compared to the 1990s, the 60s and 70s, I mean, after Stalin, were relatively prosperous. For the surviving Communist Party of the Russian Federation, The 1990s seemed to discredit the anti-communists in Eastern Europe, because somehow it was they, not the dominant party members of the CPSU, that destroyed the USSR and established this, what they would call this Masonic White Guard Western capitalism. Of course, it's absurd, but at least I understand where it comes from. The good thing is that the U.S. and liberalism, the official ideology of the regime, also discredited itself, because they backed, they supported, they financed, they justified the great criminal revolution, which was very Jewish, dismemberment of the Russian state. The great evil of this regime is that so many of these Jews still are in positions of prominence in academia and government, who were part of this, like Lawrence Summers and so many others. That the destruction of entire civilizations is not enough to discredit your ideas, but it also discredited liberalism permanently. This is why I question whenever there's the protests in Kiev about the EU. No one's protesting for more of that system. There's something else going on. So this all revived the what they call the red patriotism, the anti-Western sentiments from that point of view. They created a forgery, something called the John Foster Dulles, Cold War policy speech, which I had completely forgotten about. That they're going to destroy the USSR, and that this was official government policy. It most certainly was not. It was actually taken, as my friend Mikhail Nazarov told me, from Anatoly Ivanov's novel, The Eternal Call. And in that novel, Dulles's, you could actually see so-called Dulles's speech in there. It was introduced into circulation by someone who should have known better, Oleg Platonov. And because of his authority, which was legitimate, it was taken into the arsenal of so many, especially who, less historically literate. The Dulles plan for the USSR was not real. The U.S. never sought to destroy communism. The Russian Empire, yes. The expansion of any empire that threatened to exclude the U.S. and the dollar from trade, yes, it doesn't matter what it is, had nothing to do with Bolshevism. It could be anything, if it's growing too large. But you don't need a forgery like the Dulles plan to see that anti-communism, to the extent that it existed, was anti-Russia, or really anti-anything that would get in the way of globalization. So really, it was in the post-Soviet period, the early post-Soviet period. And I should note that Platonov, I've cited him many times, I read him on a regular basis, I like him. He's one of these people, along with Dugin, who accept the thesis that Stalin was a great man, maybe not a messianic figure, but something approaching that. But it was in the 90s that this stuff really came out. The National Bolshevik Movement came into its own. A huge number, far more than in the post-war USSR. Khrushchev, of course, exposed the cult of personality. But keep in mind, too, that Brezhnev quietly rehabilitated the Stalin era. It didn't help that Khrushchev himself was generally incompetent, and that leaked into de-Stalinization. But Khrushchev's program undermined the faith in the party, which was something that you simply couldn't do, because it was a substitute for the church. It was a church-monarch hybrid, although the dark side was meant for evil. But it plugged into the same stream of feeling. Now, when Vladimir Putin began to rebuild Russian power on a very different basis, largely in isolation from the West rather than being supported by it like you had in the Stalin era, idiots in the West tried to compare this to the building of the Soviet Union, especially the Stalin era. Now, some people will say that Putin is following that model so that, you know, church figures back then don't have to repent of anything that they did. But I don't normally take that line. One thing that Putin does that drives me up a wall more than anything, it goes against me like rat poison, is the romanticization of the Great Patriotic War, the great victory for all time. Because you can't help but romanticize Stalin in the process. Somehow presented to the people as a source of Russian national pride, justifying communist crimes. Now, Putin personally doesn't do that. You know what he says about that. He has a very complex point of view. He was a part of it. He's well aware of Jewish power and all this stuff. But sometimes, mentally, it's hard to avoid. You could even say that the 1990s were a new time of troubles. There was a vacuum. Now, of course, vacuums either don't exist or can't last more than the equivalent of a few seconds. Something has to rule. At the time, of course, it was Jewish oligarchy. But the only other easily accessible image was, of course, the cult of Stalin. And he satisfied, the image of him satisfied different points of view. People who had been robbed and dispossessed by the Jews could remember there's this whole story and Stalin was anti-Jewish, which of course is nonsense. People who wanted to punish the oligarchs, the expropriators, and maybe even certain newly powerful people themselves, because they could justify their point of view by war. And the opposition, at least for a while, was led by the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, Zhuganov and others. And they began to reformulate Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism. And I have to admit, you know, I've read much of his stuff. I've cited some of his stuff, both the Ukrainian version and the old Ukrainian version and the Russian version. They've abandoned atheism, all this kind of thing, but you can't have a picture of Tsar Nicholas with the hammer and sickle on top of it. And I've seen this on letterheads before. Of course, I've never dealt with Joseph Dugasvili as a man. I get asked once in a blue moon about the seminary, the Orthodox connection with him. Let's get this out of the way. He's not a Jew. DZU does not mean Jew. In Georgian, Jew was Israeli. Now, he was born, as many of you know, near Tiflis, actually Tiflis province, the 9th of December, 1879. That would be December 22nd, the new style at the same time. Of course, at the time, the shortest day of the year, the longest night. Now, that might not be an exact date, but Stalin celebrated it on that day. In other words, he wanted it to be the day he was born. That day is celebrated now. His father, by I think all accounts, Stalin's daughter actually has a book out called 20 Letters to a Friend, in English. I think it's in English. Spoke of Stalin's father, Vissarion. He was an alcoholic. He beat his wife and then eventually left the family and was murdered in a drunken brawl somewhere. His national origin is unclear. And Stalin went out of his way to conceal it. So that means you have, you know, Dugasvili, you don't see that name in Georgian. But it allowed speculation to take over. I recently read the article in Russian Stalin's Family by Zolin. He is part of the Encyclopedic Fund of Russia. But you do have some mainstream, not just nutties, but mainstream historians who want to claim that there's a Jewish origin of Stalin's father's family. And it goes, you know, along the lines of that they were descended from the Caucasus Mountain Jews, even pre-Khazar, who converted to Christianity beginning of the 19th century. There's a few other versions. Stalin's father came from the Ossetian Zhugayev family. and that he was the illegitimate son of a traveler and merchant, Przewalski. But that's not the most important thing here. He was born into an Orthodox family. He was baptized as an infant. His mother wanted him to become a priest. And he was educated that way. 1886, 1888, he had to learn Russian, of course. And he was accepted into the Gori Theological School. And then he passed the entrance exam to the Tiflis Theological Seminary. Now, seminaries back then were not just for theology. They were liberal arts institutions. So you had an underground Marxist school there. And he wrote in his works, volume 13, he says, "I joined the revolutionary movement at the age of 15 when I got involved with an underground group of Russian Marxists who were living then in Transcaucasia. These groups had a great influence on me and instilled me a taste for underground Marxist literature." It's unclear whether he met them in the seminary or at that era, but he dropped out in 1899. Well, he was expelled. The official reason is that he failed to appear for exams for an unknown or unjustified reason. It's important to note this because that was a major moment. It had a huge impact on his moral state. He was not an atheist by birth. He was not a Jew. He didn't have that background from the womb. Most of his party members did. He knew it at one point and consciously betrayed it. And he never repented of that. And not only that, but persecuted it violently. There is no such thing as a vacuum. If you renounce God, you take the side of Satan. There is no abstract middle ground. If you remove one power, another power has to come in and take its place. While universals exist, abstractions are simply abbreviations. They actually don't. If you know the truth and reject it and persecute it, you then serve Satan's purposes. He became a professional revolutionary and a party that had as a huge part of its agenda the destruction of the church, the destruction of the old world, the universal stronghold of Orthodoxy, the Third Rome, to remove the restrainer. And Stalin was one of the things that it was meant to restrain. The party, in many ways, took the place of the church. It covered all aspects of life. While there are spiritual directives and canons and commandments in Orthodoxy, you have something similar, but for the opposite point of view, replacing service to the good and truth and logos with its opposite. And you see this with the nature of their political methods, that nothing was ever off the table. It didn't matter, let alone their personal lives. But mass murder and killing and theft, this was perfectly acceptable. And he started off as an ordinary criminal killer. You know, his party career was just as an enforcer. There's a book by Konstantin Makhmudov. I'm going to quote him here. "There was not enough money from those sympathetic to the revolutionary movement. So then Ulanov, or that is Lenin, gathered around himself the most loyal comrades, among who was Soso Dushashvili, with the criminal nickname of Koba. This group created several gangs engaged in robbery and racketeering in favor of the revolution. Dushashvili arrived in Baku to organize strikes, walkouts, and any fight against the legitimate government. Having settled there in Baku, he organized a gang with which he raided banks, mail trains, and oil fields." So it wasn't, you know, the terrorism used by numerous leftist parties, going back to the murder of Alexander II, they didn't just kill policemen, security guards. They killed random people all the time. In the so-called Tiflis expropriation alone, in 1 year, 1907, they killed 40 people. And according to the police, over several years in that era, the total amount stolen from the Marxist robberies down there, total, was about 3 million rubles. Now, depending on who you read, he had about either between 5 or 7 prison terms during his Baku period, present-day Azerbaijan, but only one of them was for political reasons. Ordinarily, it was just for theft and robbery. You didn't have a prison system in the USS, in the Russian Empire ever. Exile to Siberia wasn't much of a punishment because you were housed with ordinary people. So between 1909 and 1912, he was exiled, I don't know, 3-4 times at least, and he always got back in Vologda, actually. That's where his illegitimate son was born. So in 1912, Central Committee meeting, that's where Stalin adopted the name Stalin. His pseudonym included Besosvili from Besho, which actually, you know, has a demonic background to it, but sometimes it's an abbreviation of the name Vissarion. But it was also something Luciferian, insolence, which Stalin used to brag about. He was brought into the Central Committee in 1912. That very same year, though, he was arrested again and sent to exile in Siberia again, to Tomsk. Sverdlov was already there. And after a short time, he got back, he escaped. There's no bars, there's no prison here. Which I think is something to be happy about, but not for these people. Then he got to Switzerland, and he had a forged passport. I mean, this was all easily organizable at the time. I don't know what kind of authoritarian system you could possibly have. He got back to St. Petersburg, and then he worked for Pravda there. That's how cruel and evil the Tsarist system was. He was arrested the following year, 1913, and exiled farther away, Yenisei province. And then, of course, same thing. He got back to Petrograd in 1917. He had another illegitimate child, by the way, from cohabitation with a minor, a girl. Now, after Stalin's death, Serov, the chairman of the KGB, made a report to the Politburo on some facts and the biography of Stalin during his early years when he was in exile from 1913 to 1917. The report's dated June 4th, 1956. The KGB chairman said the following. According to the testimony of citizen Pelagina, it is estimated that Stalin, while at Kurikia, at the age of 14, seduced this girl and began to cohabit with her. She was 14. In connection with this, Stalin was summoned to the gendarme Lautian to be brought to criminal responsibility for cohabitation with a minor. Stalin gave his word to marry her when she became an adult. That same girl said in May of that year, now in the 50s, she gave birth to a child in 1913 who died in 1914. Second child was born, named Alexander. After the end of exile, Stalin left, and she ended up marrying by force a local peasant who adopted the boy Alexander. Throughout her life, Stalin never provided her with any help. Currently, her son Alexander serves in the Soviet Army and is a major. So, like all normal countries, there were laws against what we would call statutory rape. Stalin, of course, long an adult, was living with a 14-year-old. Now, this was signed by all members of the Politburo, very famous men, Bulganin, Vorosilov, Milenko-Kaganovich, Molotov, Khrushchev. Now, because this report, it was never refuted, it didn't cause any problem. People weren't outraged by this. Because all these guys knew Stalin for a long time. That's how you know that the facts here are true. They would have tried to repress it or lie about it or say that this is from black-hunted clergymen or something stupid. they kind of rolled their eyes because this was normal for him and normal for them. This was a large-scale investigation by the KGB. The fact that there was a large-scale investigation in the first place suggests that there's a lot more going on here. Now, the KGB itself, where this was done initially in Siberia, and putting this all together, they had to wonder, you know, is this going to get us in trouble? But they sent it to the Politburo anyway. But there is no evidence in any way that Stalin's pedophilia ever, you know, was refuted or caused any outrage or even doubt among his, either the authors or the comrades that he was working with. 14, 15 years old, but that was perfectly normal. But maybe more importantly than that, going into exile apparently didn't mean anything. You had to have an organization. The Communist Party back then was like a mafia group. You know, they had racketeering, no different than any organized crime body. But when you don't have a prison system, and again, I have a huge problem with prisons. Michael Hoffman just wrote something about that recently. In no way is this anything, but I mean, this is a libertarian paradise by comparison to, say, the U.S. in 2025. Now, there was some suspicion that he was working with the police. Maybe that's part of why he never seemed to get in any trouble. He got in no trouble with his pedophilia, even though she was, you know, obviously post-puberty. But whatever connection he had, it was simply to promote himself. He had a lot of people like that, like Malinovsky, Azev, people working with the police for financial gain or whatever it is. Keep in mind also that during the February Revolution, many police archives were burned by the revolutionaries precisely to cover up these kind of things. Now, the First World War broke out. The extreme left sought the total defeat of the Tsarist government. You got lots of leftists who didn't like that idea. The slogan was to transform the imperialist war, that is to say World War I, into a civil war. There was no controls over the border. You know, these revolutionaries came and went. When Lenin got back to Russia, he was all in favor of this. This was his idea. So chaos in order to transform the February Revolution into what they call a proletarian socialist one, into a civil war. And Stalin continued to be promoted up the ranks. Now remember, the February Revolution, the Kerensky Revolution, Lenin had nothing to do with that. Now if you read the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, they completely rewrote history such that they were a part of all of this and they were lovers of freedom. The one thing that they're not going to talk to you about is that since at least 1915, the Bolshevik movement, Lenin's front in particular, was financed by Germany, but from loans from Jewish banks in the U.S. and England. Germany had absolutely no money to spare. We've spoken of the Parvus Memorandum and the financing of the anti-Russian forces. That was adopted officially by the German leadership in the spring of 1915. The Jewish bankers placed their bets not so much on Kerensky, but on Lenin. Keep in mind that at this point in time, there were two vectors of the revolution, Lenin's group and Trotsky's group. For the most part, they were allied, but they were financed from two different places. But this money is what helped the Bolsheviks seize power. And, of course, many of you know Anthony Sutton's Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, which goes into great detail, talking about the memorandum of William Boyce Thompson, the director of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, and that memorandum to Lloyd George, written 1917, about why it's necessary to support the Bolsheviks against the whites. And Thompson said, because Russia is the greatest war trophy the world has ever known. In her size, she was exploding in population. Well, until then, oil. I mean, you know, Russia is completely self-sufficient if she wanted to be in everything. Lloyd George, in his own memoirs, admits that he had no intention of overthrowing Soviet power. There was no intervention to fight the Soviets. There was intervention, but it had zero to do with Bolshevism. While the war was still going on, it was to restore the front against Germany. After the war, you had various reasons to protect the oil wells in Baku, or in the British case, to support the independent Baltic states. And all their ammunition stores that they brought with them were either destroyed, dumped into the ocean, as the French did, or sell it to the Bolsheviks, as the Americans did. Now, after the Bolsheviks seized power, Stalin was part of the Council of People's Commissars as a People's Commissar for Nationalities. Because in 1913, Stalin wrote an article called Marxism and the National Question, which we have dealt with on this show many times. But from that time on, just writing that article, he was then considered an expert, somehow, on the issue. Stalin joined the main organ, the new government, the Bureau of the Central Committee, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, Bolshevik, with Lenin, Trotsky, and Sverdlov. So from the takeover of the entire empire, from 1918 to 1922, Stalin was a member of the Revolutionary Military Councils of the Western, Southern, and Southwestern Fronts. And he was successful because he had zero concern with human life. He would sacrifice huge numbers of men to get his way, which makes sense if you're a materialist, because everything's just matter and motion. So there really is no moral problem here. Russian historian Litvin wrote in The Red and White Terror of Russia, 1918-1922, he says, in Tsaritsyn, summer of 1918, Stalin dealt with people's lives in a simpler and just as criminal way. He created a floating prison on a barge. He arrested military specialists, and these are former Tsarist officers who had gone over to the Red Army, mostly under threat of arresting their families. They were shot and drowned. Using the powers he had received from Lenin, he unleashed an orgy of terror, but the Czechist funeral team did not have time to bury the victims of the firing squad. Lenin actually had to reason with him. Stalin's slogan was not one step back in the defense of Tsaritsyn in 1918. And his military strategy then and right up until World War II is using detachments to keep anyone from retreating, blocking detachments, and they would shoot anyone who tried to retreat. After enormous losses, General Krasnov's White Army was driven back on August 23rd of that year. Lengthy battle, Stalin sacrificed 60,000 men, and Lenin was upset. But it wasn't, you know, this was around the time where he was elected the member of the Central Committee, both local and federal, and the general secretary of the Central Committee, while Lenin held the post of chairman, the Council of People's Commissar. Lenin didn't last much longer. He was sick and died, and Stalin then strengthened his influence, usually using these Machiavellian tactics. But he was already pretty famous because it was because of the Tsaritsyn slaughter. In 1925, they changed the name of that city to Stalingrad. And that city that became a cult center as the Stalin cult grew stronger. Didn't take long then. The Assumption Cathedral, the Trinity Church, Church of St. John the Baptist were destroyed. The Holy Spirit Monastery was turned into a gulag camp. And the Komsomol commune. The garage was set up in the St. Alexander Nevsky Cathedral, etc., etc., etc. They finally just blew it up in 1932. Now, we've dealt with the issue of his attacks on nationalism, and especially Russian nationalism, many times before. In Pravda, in 1923, his theses for the 12th Congress, approved by the Central Committee, For Stalin, it was a decisive struggle against the remnants of great Russian chauvinism. That is the first and immediate task of our party. It had nothing to do with workers, nothing to do with labor, nothing to do with you. It was to make sure that Russians can't rule in their own country. So the inclusion of the Donbass in the Ukrainian SSR, where they Ukrainianized it, the deportation of many peoples, but we know his actions speak for themselves. Collectivization, you know, I mean, 10 million is such a, I think, a low number. Even the godless five-year plan, just from 1937 to 1938, 106,800 clergymen were shot. And the Great Terror of 1937, punitive orders during wartime. Most Russian casualties were actually shot by these party-based blocking detachments. Maybe not most, but a huge amount. And, of course, the Leningrad Affair. The Leningrad Affair, I did a whole show on this, was about stopping any concept of Russian nationalism. And I can't get into it now, but the Leningrad Affair was about Russians wanting a greater role in their own country. That is to say, Russia as such, not the Soviet Union. Now, how do these Red Patriots justify this? Well, one way is that it was necessary for industrialization. And they say that without this, the war absolutely could not have been won. This whole myth that the Soviet Union, after World War I, after the Civil War, the complete collapse of its economy, the starvation, everything else, somehow they had the resources to build heavy industry. The old slogan is that Stalin led this development from the plow to the atomic bomb. Of course, we know that this is nonsense. The Western world built Soviet industry. They also say that Stalin knew nothing about the persecution. Platonov says that this was Jewish Bolsheviks behind his back that was doing all of this. And yet, in his own article on Pravda, the anniversary of the revolution, November 7th, 1929, that's where he announced collectivization and the purges that he signed the execution list with his own hand. The claim is that once he learned about these terrible things that were happening in his name, that's where the anti-Jewish purge came from. And that's why the Jews hate him so much. It's utter nonsense. The Red Patriots claim that these purges were the best thing Stalin has ever done. He nationalized the formerly cosmopolitan party. And that's the main goal of Stalin's terror. And that's why Platonov called Stalin the national leader of the Russian people in his book, The History of the Russian People, Volume 2. Which, by the way, in many other ways, is a brilliant book. And the claim is that Stalin was an awful man because in 1937, he purged many of the older Leninist guard. And of course, Jews only see Jews as victims and no one else. Well, because Jews were so dominant in the early Bolshevik party, any purge of the old Bolsheviks is going to have a lot of Jews in it. But Jews that played their cards right and agreed with them, people like Kaganovich, Beria, Meklis, so many others, Zalkind, they all remained in high positions and continued the war against the Russian nation. In fact, the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party, March 1939, said the number of Jews in power increased. In fact, on that very body, it went up from 10 to 11. Of all those, and you could divide them by ethnic group or religious group, of all the groups persecuted at that time, Jews were the least. 29,000 were arrested by the NKVD between 1937 and 1938, which is, given the scale of what was happening, is very, but it doesn't matter. I mean, they're Jews, so. And you have Jewish publication, a writer, Stalin's Secret Policy, Kostoretska. But despite these alleged anti-Jewish purges, throughout the 1940s, the role of Jews in the punitive organs remained very noticeable. That's from the article Jews and the Apparatus of the Cheka Ogpu in the 1920s. That came out in 1999. Now, what did he say? On the eve of these purges, he sent reassuring signals to loyal Jews. In Avestia, they reprinted one of his programmatic statements. It was dated January 12, 1931. Communists, as consistent internationalists, cannot but be irreconcilable and sworn enemies of anti-Semitism. In the USSR, anti-Semitism is most strictly prosecuted by law as a phenomenon deeply hostile to the Soviet system. Active anti-Semites are punishable by death under the laws of the Soviet Union. Direct quote from him, 1931. Stalin said at the 8th Congress, the Soviets of the USSR, statement by Stalin, said this: our fraternal feelings for the Jewish people are determined by the fact that it gave birth to the brilliant creator of the ideas of the communist liberation of man, Karl Marx. The Jewish people have given many glorious heroes of the revolutionary struggle against the oppressors of the workers in our country, have put forward and are putting forward more and more remarkable, talented leaders. That's Avestia, November 30th, 1936. And if you look, it's also in his collected works, the 13th volume, page 28. The Brief Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 8, it says the following: many Jews who achieved social success in the 20s and 30s were persecuted in 1937-1938. However, it was precisely at the end of the 1930s that the role of the Jews in various spheres of life in Soviet society reached its zenith. Government employees made up over 40% of the entire active Jewish population. In 1939-1941, there were no overt manifestations of anti-Semitism in the USSR. The authorities' policies were characterized by a kind of anti-Semitism, a complete disregard for everything that concerned the situation of the Jews. Now, that last line, I don't know what he means by that, but clearly, not only was anti-Semitism illegal, and people were prosecuted constantly for that, but even the Jews have to admit that this had nothing to do with them being Jews, depended on who and what, if they threatened Stalin in some way. The simple fact is, he relied on the numerically superior Russian nation in his rivalry with Trotsky, which was a huge, you know, the Jewish issue was huge there. Trotsky was just as vicious as Stalin during the Civil War, whether it be over the building the Marxism in one country versus a global revolution. But that only happened after Stalin had already conquered Russia, broken Russia's back with collectivization and the godless five-year plan. This was about personal power, certainly not ideology. Stalin had no conception of any of the Jewish question as such. If you go back a few years, the Orthodox nationalist, I go into great detail of how Stalin, the USSR, created the present state of Israel. They were the first to recognize it. They were the first to defend it in the UN. He recognized it even before the US supplied it with money and weaponry. Now, it was only when Soviet Jews, and it's interesting because it was so many of the, it was the wives of the high-ranking party members, they began to think that that Jewish state is their national homeland, Stalin, for purely pragmatic reasons, decided to reduce their numbers. That's the nonsense of the campaign against cosmopolitans or the doctor's plot. There's a claim that there was a plan for the deportation of the Jews in 1952-53. There are no documents in existence that suggest that. It's an old myth. Platonov and his allies suggest that this is why Stalin died on Purim in 1953. And that, at least in part, makes him the national leader of the Russian people. The persecutions of huge numbers of people were never hidden by anybody. They were always justified because, allegedly, Russia's enemies were everywhere, which simply isn't true. The enemies of the people. Stalin was well aware that Western capitalism was deeply involved in the industrialization of the Soviet Union. But some even go farther, saying that there were no mass murders in the USSR, that these were not political, that criminals, embezzlers, whatever, and that they were exaggerated by anti-communists later on. There was an entire movement in American academia in the 1970s, Holocaust denial, just in the Soviet case, which I know they did on purpose, denying Stalin's crimes. You get tenure, you deny some of the crimes of Hitler, you get destroyed. But on that score, a book Vladimir Zemskov wrote on the scale of political repressions in the USSR, professor, he said that in the end of 1953, the Soviet Ministry of Internal Affairs prepared a reference note, I'm quoting now, based on the statistical reporting of the first special department of the USSR Ministry of Internal Affairs. It named the number of people convicted of counter-revolutionary and other especially dangerous state crimes for the period from January 1, 1921 to July 1, 1953 at 4,060,306 people. Now, that's an extremely low figure, but he's very clear. It's just people convicted of counter-revolutionary and other similar crimes. But that's just those convicted. You have 15 million at least killed during the Civil War, Mother Red. 10 million victims of dispossession and forcible relocation, not to mention the artificial famines, collectivization. Those convicted, well, that doesn't include God knows how many shot without trial. Disenfranchised family members of those very same people, those who were exiled, deported, as those convicted under non-political articles, things like, you know, economic crimes, using the word Yid or anti-Jewish jokes was a big one. Any communication with foreigners. They were declared crimes at the time, and they were strictly political. Crimes like during the famine, any kind of illegal trade in grain. If you flee from famine-stricken territories, which is a violation of the passport regulations. You had this in Kazakhstan. Picking ears of grain, being late for work, praising the Western standard of living and so many other things, it doesn't include them. That's a very high number. Now, the Supreme Council of the Russian Federation, when they were preparing the law on the rehabilitation of the persecuted, the repressed, that was in 1991. The Ministry of Internal Affairs provided information on the number of people. And this is strictly political persecution. 50,114,267. Now, that still doesn't include the victims of the Red Terror, the Civil War, artificial famine. You know, when they were shooting people, and the peasant uprisings and all the rest. Even Platonov, in his book, Memories of the National Economy, came out in 1990. Platonov says this. According to our calculations, remember, he worked at the Central Statistical Bureau for a while. The total number of people who died an unnatural death from mass repressions, famine, epidemics, wars, amounted to more than 87 million people from 1918 to 1953. Not just part of the population perished, but the best part of the population. And in total, if we add up the number of people who died an unnatural death, who left their homeland, as well as the number of children who could have been born to these people, then the total human damage to the country will amount to over 156 million people. Calculations of the emigre professor Ivan Kaganov, using Soviet statistics officially, he says from 1917 to 1959, the country lost 110 million people. 66 million in the non-war period of the so-called socialist transformations. That's from his book, Three Figures. It came out, that was in 1977. Now, in many ways, Stalin's purges kept, despite the fact that the Soviet Union was built by Western capital, the question, you know, why didn't that lead to the USSR being a colony? And Stalin's purges is the answer. Western oligarchs tolerated Stalin's victory within the party. They were in no position to fight with him. But, of course, 1930s, the oligarchs in the West needed him for something even more important, and that is the war against fascism, National Socialism. Wall Street was financing the Soviet Union, especially in the 20s and 30s. But elsewhere in Europe, there was a reaction. The victory of the oligarchs, the Jews in the First World War. And that reaction was not accepted by, you know, what I call today the regime. They were offering a third way, this corporate-based social model, which actually worked in practice, abolishing the banker parasite. And of course, the parties they financed disrupted the regime's plans for Europe. Now, we could vaguely call that fascism, but I guess you could do that. Before the Second World War, it didn't have the meaning it has today. National Socialism and fascism are two different things. But you have things like Catholic social doctrine. Prominent European economists participated in that movement. You had, you know, fascist parties. But these countries demonstrated huge economic success. And they had broad popular support. And the regime has always struggled with that. Usually they lie. Or they somehow explain it away. Unfortunately, someone like Mussolini, who was an atheist, you had these pagan non-Christian features, and it was going to be doomed to defeat. So what to do? Hitler's revolution in the 30s was extremely successful. He did what the communists said they were going to do. That wasn't just him. Franco's Spain in the 1950s did extremely well. This stuff actually worked in practice. It was an anti-oligarchic movement that still believed in private property. So the only way to deal with this was another massive pan-European war. They needed a pretext, an aggressor. The writer Boris Golovsky, talking about the alliance between Stalin and Germany in 1934, trying to eliminate the danger. I mean, I think this was very naive of people to write this. Stalin was the aggressor all over the place. Bukharin spoke to the U.S. Ambassador about the purges, especially of the elite. And here's what he said. They dealt with everyone who might have thought not to accept the idea of the agreement with Hitler's Germany. The reprisals intensified, especially when the two largest NKVD residents abroad, who worked in close contact with the apparatus, not only broke with the NKVD, but also began to make revelations in the foreign press. These were Rees and Krivitsky, both Jews, and it's obvious that their decision was influenced by Stalin's plans to enter into an alliance with the militant anti-Semite Hitler. This is part of the reason that Litvinov was replaced, the head of foreign affairs, by Molotov. Eventually led to the pact in 1939. It was quite logical. Stalin, I think, was a lot more devious and Machiavellian than the Westerners. Hitler occupied a substantial chunk of Europe, but not nearly as rapidly and totally as Stalin did. I mean, Stalin said, we want Finland, Romania, Bulgaria, the Straits of the Mediterranean to come under Soviet influence. Of course, Hitler could not accept this. Now, we've been through this before. Hitler was in no position to go to war against the vastly superior military of Stalin. Stalin was planning, and I think there's no doubt about this anymore, that he was planning an invasion of Europe. I want to quote from Icebreaker here. Of course, Suvorov's famous, but one of my favorite books these days. And this brings everything into clear focus. Here's a strange state of affairs. Germany attacked Poland, which means that Germany was the instigator of and participant in the European and then the World War. The Soviet Union did the same thing in the same month, but it does not judge itself to have been an instigator of the war, nor does it consider itself even to have been a participant in the war. Germany seized Denmark. That was an act of war, even though no great battle was fought. The Soviet Union also seized, without firing a shot, three Baltic states, markedly similar to Denmark in geographical position and size of population. But the actions of the Soviet Union are not judged to be acts of war. Germany seized Norway. That was a further act of aggression. But before that happened, the Soviet Union have carved up neighboring Finland. The list of crimes committed by Germany in the war begins on September 1939. Well, the list of the Red Army's crimes begins for some reason only June 22, 1941. Now, we all know what that means. The regime had continued, the oligarchy had continued to throw its weight behind the Soviet Union. They didn't agree with him on everything, but Hitler absolutely had to go. The understanding of Stalin's crimes was actively suppressed in the Western media. Anyone sympathetic to National Socialism, however, was hounded out of public life. Stalin repudiated the rules of war to the cheers of Washington. So it's very hard to see what the Allies were fighting for other than Jewish oligarchy. The savage victors of 1945 had to console themselves. Their guilt for the mass slaughter of German civilians and the mass murder of German POWs. So they had to invent things like the exaggerated stories of Hitler and the Holocaust. Stalin then said, after Germany's doomed preemptive attack on Stalin's empire, Stalin actually told Harriman, Avril Harriman, the authorized representative of President Roosevelt, Stalin said, "We know that people do not want to fight for the world revolution. They won't fight for Soviet power either. Maybe they'll fight for Russia." And in that line summarizes the devious, the lies, the mythology of the Soviet Union and Stalin's Soviet Union. So May 9th becomes the victory day over fascism. Unfortunately, the myths of the Great Patriotic War have become the foundation of Putin's historical understanding. And it's a huge error. And we know why. It extended the rule of Stalin, destroyed any leftist, anti-leftist movement in Europe. It made the world safe for Stalinist atheism and internationalism. And somehow people still want to square the circle here. They want to put a Christian image onto a war fought for the glory of materialism, atheism, and the gulag. Stalin's church, and many churches in the West actually, invented a narrative that Stalin was a Christian warrior fighting the pagan Germans. And this story is enforced today in Europe with legal sanctions. It's unfortunate that it's a part of the official Russian ideology right now. It cannot be justified at any level, in any way. And it creates a cognitive dissonance that, thank God, we don't suffer with. Now, Trotsky, on the other hand, was able to build even better bridges with the internationalists and the capitalists. Stalin didn't really want to talk about his foreign connections. He may accuse his enemies of this, but any investigation into this would have compromised the entire Bolshevik Party. They came to power with foreign money. Stalin himself was involved in all of this. And even if they were correct, even if these people were correct about what Stalin did, he'd never return the country to truth and genuine nationalism. The most he did, and this very poorly, he used external features of the tradition to strengthen his own power. The only ideology that was true doctrine was Marxism. And it certainly didn't mean any weakening of the persecutions against Russians. Very briefly and purely superficially, there was a semi-national mutation of Bolshevism. It didn't last very long. Clearly didn't benefit anybody. If it did, it's not due to Stalin. It's due to Russia itself. I haven't gotten to so many of the millions of desertions from Stalin's army. The very fact that Stalin had to have entire divisions dedicated to shooting deserters, blocking battalions, numerous Joachim Hoffman has great detail about this. Every officer had a party functionary. He trusted nobody because, as he said to Harriman, no one's going to fight for this abstraction of the USSR. No one's going to fight for the global revolution. National Bolshevism itself, it prevented the resurrection of a genuine Russian nationalism. Because now, if someone like me talks about this, people may still be thinking about the Stalinist, you know, icons. To assert, as liberals in the West and many others did for a long time, that the only executioner of the people was Stalin, who distorted Lenin's teachings, of course, is falsehood. And I've said this many times. The West saw the Soviet Union as a wave of the future. Stalin disrupted their plans in a few different ways. In order to save socialism, they say everything was just Stalin. He was this aberration. Everyone else was fine, especially Lenin, especially Trotsky. They say the same thing for Zionism. Oh, this is all Netanyahu and the Likud party. No, that's Zionism from its founding. Crimes committed today are nothing new. You even have people who want to claim that there was this happy citizens in the Stalinist era. The problem with that, I'm sure they come up with a whole bunch of them, is that the untold millions who were killed, well, they don't have descendants. They're in no position to speak. They can't talk about the earthly paradise with their testimonies. One of the favorite myths about Stalin that they talk about was his personal modesty, his selflessness. Remember, Stalin lived entirely on the state. His budget, personal budget, was not controlled by anybody. Stalin was, of course, the wealthiest man in the USSR because in a planned economy, all productive capital is owned by the state, which in this case means the party, which in this case means Stalin. All the labor of the Soviet Empire was under his control. But there was a few elements here. I don't know if I'm get a chance to do this here. The development of Stalinism as a cult had a few stages. This belief in Stalin's brilliance and omnipotence. You see this in the 1920s and the 30s. Marxism became this religious faith. Stalin's time, everything was rewritten, including, you know, faked photographs, as we all know. People disappeared. The second stage was this terror and fear. Popular Stalinism back then functioned out of fear, almost like a Stockholm syndrome. This subconscious gratitude for the fact that they killed someone else rather than me. There was a hypnosis here. In the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn, he talks about this bizarre psychological element. Many of you may even remember this. There's a party meeting, and then someone gives a speech with the obligatory praise of Stalin. The very sound of his name, the entire place stands up and applauds, interrupting the speaker, who just mentioned his name. The applause, the ovation goes on and on and on, but no one dares to stop it. Someone, finally realizing this is absurd, sits down. Then everyone else follows, and the next day, that person is arrested. Now, of course, that's mythic, but that's the mentality. It's a form of hypnosis. You had people who suffered under Stalin crying at his funeral. But then, the third stage, this patriotic national Bolshevik idea, based on the so-called Great Patriotic War. But the last thing that war was patriotic. The patriotic variety of Stalinism developed this nostalgia among the common people, even the old bureaucrats. They called it the Russian Party. This national Bolshevism, based on the idea that it's only Stalin's brilliant leadership that victory was achieved. And yes, it was very harsh, but it's because the Soviet Union was surrounded by evil enemies. Of course, Stalin opened a couple of churches, created a church himself, only because he realized the Germans were opening churches in Ukraine and elsewhere in huge numbers, proving how unpopular and laughable the Soviet system was. Just like early on in the Russian Civil War, Stalin didn't care how many men he had to sacrifice. Now, Stalin wanted to claim the number of military losses in that war was 7 million. Khrushchev said 20 million. Kurganov, as I mentioned before, gives the number of 44 million. Fourth stage, the mythology. And it comes from, as I said, the Gorbachev-Yeltsin collapse, the Great Criminal Revolution, and everything else. There was good reason to have this nostalgia, and they will invent anything in that traumatic period of time. It's a form of consolation that had already found fertile soil in the young generations. They didn't personally know the Stalinist regime. And then the theology. They justify the Russian Holocaust, Russian mass slaughter, industrialization, Jewish purges, victory in the Patriotic War, well-being of the people, whatever nonsense. And that Stalin somehow was a Christian, brought out the Christian content in the communist regime for which Stalin would have had these people shot. Let me summarize it this way. The myth of Stalin as a national leader, the Russian people, the Russian nation, where did it come from? First of all, the need of the lower classes for a strong, just, powerful government, revenge. This idealization of some pragmatic aspects of Stalin's policy, making it act like this was ideological. Of course, Stalin made some good decisions. That's not a monopoly of him. Anywhere you go, intelligent rulers made good decisions. You can't take those things and turn them into a huge programmatic campaign. Didn't exist. Didn't happen. Especially when you're struggling for survival, the jungle of the great criminal revolution of the 1990s, compared with Brezhnev, the Brezhnev era, that was starting to look amazing. The second part, the need, the elite. The former bureaucrats back then of the CPSU, the KGB, they had to cover up possibly their own personal criminality. Whatever personal responsibility they had, the gulag wasn't abolished until the 80s. Late 80s. Gorbachev. So idealizing certain aspects of that system, somehow justifying their own position in the process, well, it's now in their interest to do that. But let's not kid ourselves. The fact is, Stalin remained in power because of the victory against the Germans. It's true, his military apparatus, thanks to the West, was the most advanced on the planet at the time. Had Stalin not planned a massive invasion of Europe, Germany could never have pulled off Barbarossa. He ran out of ammunition and fuel in Poland after 6 weeks. Germans were, there was no question they were going to lose here. That's why her advance, the gates of Moscow, stalled. But Germany's defeat was the end of Christian Europe, the last gasp. Stalin closed the churches that the Germans opened, but still pretended to be the savior of Christian Europe. Westerners have to believe this, or else, they have to say we were supporting the most evil anti-Christian system that ever existed. That can't be true. So Stalin was, he did nationalize the party. The truth is that most of what the regime in the West teaches its people are its myth, stories that justify its totalitarian rule. And it's no different elsewhere. Almost everything that the average educated American believes is a myth. The USSR was at war with Russia and her church. That church was a font of truth in a sick world. So an entire phalanx of lies were constructed to argue the impossible, that Stalin was the beloved of God. Outside of the USSR, at the time, the Christian world stood behind Germany. Russia remains the restrainer for all of its flaws. But that job is going to get more and more and more difficult when you try to square the circle of this national Bolshevik Stalinism. And it doesn't matter what you say, the evidence, they'll take a couple of bits and pieces and turn it into a grand theory that he attempted to nationalize and orthodoxize the party. And because he died on Purim, that means he was murdered by the Jews. Stalin was not a nationalist. He was not Christian. He was nothing but a very, very wicked pedophile. And nationalists, wherever they are, can't take him seriously as somehow the figure of Russian strength and Russian power. There's plenty of other people to use. I understand where it came from. I get it. I understand the conditions of Russia in the 1990s. I wish none of you ever go through anything like that. That's economic collapse that I don't think anyone, any civilization has experienced. I get it. This is, you know, deflection, projection, whatever the defense mechanism is. But regardless of what it comes from, where it comes from, why it is, it's not real. Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening to me. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.